I'm Dan Erlander, and this is the second session of two parts on worship renewal. And now we're going to have a little review. So we talked yesterday first about the problem in worship in our church, and I don't think we exactly defined the problem. We talked about everything from people being upset about changes in the liturgy and the attempts of using balloons and things to create worship reform. But I think what we basically, the problem we came into this century with and into our lifetimes and our generation with in worship is that we had a lot of different stuff coming from, partly from the ancient tradition of the church, a lot from the medieval times, the way we build our church buildings, a lot from the 19th century, from the American experience, and then every congregation has its own worship patterns that are unbreakable. And did anybody have an outstanding one from your congregation, like your own very own worship tradition with a small t that would be unbreakable?
Well, not from the congregation I'm at, but this was an experience I had in seminary, where during the synod convention, a lot of the seminarians would go out to supply. So I went out to supply at this congregation, and I did the whole service, and I thought very well. And as I was standing there coming out, I had an alb on, and the person said two things. I like what you seminarians have to wear, meaning the alb, and maybe you'll learn where to stand by the time you're finished. Because I stood in where their pastor didn't stand. Oh. And so I was doing it wrong.
Okay. I think we ended up yesterday sharing partly the way we do live in such a world of change, that I think we all feel this in different ways how when we go to church, that's a problem phrase in itself. We are the church going to the building. But when we gather for worship, in some ways we say, oh, I finally want a haven where nothing changes. Do we all kind of identify with that? And one of the jokes we have down in the Resource Center, we have a whole board of jokes, and one is the candle has fallen over and the altar cloth is burning up and the priest is coming running with a fire extinguisher to put it out, and the little caption, two women are sitting in the congregation and one says, "Thank God, I thought it was another liturgical change." Or one, our worship committee chairperson, this is the same person that liked the King James for Christmas Eve. One Sunday for the passing of the peace, he turned to the woman next to him, held out his hand, and she said, "I don't do that." Or I read, even more extreme, I read about a Roman Catholic parish in Wisconsin where a farmer had shook the hands with a woman in real estate during the passing of the peace, hurt her hand, and she was suing for $90,000 for damages. So that, well.
When they first started passing the peace, I know some of our congregation was very put out. They thought it was awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we shared yesterday how that is probably next to the Eucharist itself is probably the most ancient tradition, and I think there's strong evidence that the passing of the peace goes back to the risen Christ meeting the disciples after the resurrection. And we don't have the only tradition that's more ancient would be the institution of the Lord's Supper, and but it is interesting how, because it fell out of practice for so many years, when it came back in, then it seemed like a innovation. Part of the problem with we teach people well, and this is encouraging. The church does teach people well, and this is very. Makes me optimistic. For example, we really taught people well that you shouldn't talk in church, right? Didn't you grow up that you don't talk in church? And And I remember growing up with a lot of anti-Catholicism, but I remember when my father would criticize the Roman Catholic Church, he would always end with this, at least they're quiet in church. You know, at least they're quiet in church. And so we taught this very, very well, and then all of a sudden we have a part in our liturgy that we introduce where everybody's supposed to start talking to each other. And so, but the thing that that does to me, it encourages me that we can, as a church, still teach our people, because we certainly have in the past, even if maybe there have been some of the questionable things.
One thing I noticed that when the peace is passed, our four-year-old son, that's really about the only part of the service that he really feels a part of, mm-hmm. and he can join in with everybody else mm-hmm. and pass the peace.
Yeah, I think I'd like to spend a little time here talking about inclusiveness, because often when we talk about inclusiveness, we think about men and women, or black and white, but we forget it also means all different ages. And I think the wonder of our practice of infant baptism is the inclusiveness of the gospel. It stands on that, and I think on that alone. I mean, there are no proof passages either way for infant baptism or adult baptism, because the early church wasn't fighting about that, and what they weren't fighting about didn't get down. It stands on the fact that all are part of the family. And then often we practice a certain exclusiveness as far as children are in the service. And I even have feelings about the children's sermon, because we've found a place where we can be only for children, and then it gives us an excuse to really isolate them from the whole rest of the liturgy. I like to talk a little about that. I'll share a few things on. We'll emphasize things today that I have strong feelings about. Okay. The other, when we're on the passing of the peace, I think it's important, and I found it's helpful to explain to people this, that the passing of the peace is not primarily kind of a break in the service for congeniality. And it's not when we kind of stop the ritual to just kind of walk around and chat for a while, but like everything else in the liturgy, it itself is a ritual act. And I hope by the end of today we are clear in what we mean by a ritual action. It's a dramatic movement we make with our bodies and with our mouths and with our movements and our eyes that proclaims the gospel. So by doing that action, we enter into the gospel. So the ritual action of turning and sharing shalom is a ritual action of announcing all over the inside of this building, to announce that the gospel has to do with the reconciliation of all people. So if people could understand that, in a way, when they do this, they aren't saying, oh my goodness, now the church is making me shake hands with people. But rather the church is inviting them into a ritual announcement where they really proclaim the gospel to each other and then enter into that very gospel by making this body language, you might say, a communication. I don't know, is that helpful? Rather than and therefore I've encouraged people not during the passing of the peace, it isn't the time to walk around and, you know, decide, in New Mexico it would be to decide what time you'll meet at First Cafeteria, you know, and that, or getting out of the church immediately so you get in line at First before the Baptists. So that was a very important thing in Albuquerque. Because once the Baptist churches got out, you didn't have a chance to get into the cafeteria. Well, never mind, that's irrelevant today. So, now, the other thing we talked about yesterday, and it's so important, I want to just take a minute to review it, is what we call the difference between the big T and the little T. Or the other way is to call this tradition and this convention. Tradition and convention. And if if our people are clear on the difference before, then it helps. We can still have tension over the liturgy, but if people start to learn which of the two areas we're having tension over, I think it can really loosen up our arguing, and also it can help us really when we talk to each other to really talk in terms of priorities. Or another way, Luther would have used this simile, he would have called this adiaphora. You all heard that word, adiaphora? That means things not necessary. Is that a close definition? Anybody? Adiaphora, but things that aren't absolutely necessary, and then the opposite of adiaphora. Did Luther have a word that was the opposite? Or one word or what? Does anybody remember? But it would be things essential and things that really can come and go. Now, so we looked yesterday, and a liturgical scholar I rely on is John Gallen, makes the claim that there is a worship tradition that really was handed to the church by the apostles. And we need to take that tradition as seriously as we take the doctrines of grace and the doctrines of forgiveness and the doctrine of the atonement and the sacrificial atonement of Christ and the doctrine of, the teachings of the apostles. We take those very seriously. And if the apostles also handed to the church a tradition of worship, that also needs to be taken seriously. And you can go back to the apostles, and you can also find the beginning of this in the New Testament itself, a tradition that when the congregation of Christians gathers together to worship, they really do this. And that is, they tell the story, and then someone preaches, and then they pray for others, and then they bring gifts of food, and those gifts are blessed, and then those gifts are shared. And we want to talk a little more then today about what we mean by ritual, but this is the ritual that was handed down, that just no matter if you're meeting out in the woods with six people on a camping and have some bread, and this then becomes the tradition that you would open up the scripture, read, either one person or several would share on that scripture, then you would pray for people all over the world. I forgot the one is a peace. It's also, and then you would do the ritual of sharing the shalom, and then you would bring food to the table, bread and wine included, and then that would be blessed and then shared as the meal. You know, and whether you're in a gigantic cathedral, you know, dressed in all the ancient vestments of the church, you know, chasubles and whatever you call everything that you would put on, and on whether you would do this or whether you're with the two or three people out in the woods, then this is what Christians do when they share in their main worship, weekly worship experience. Okay, then the conventions, or what John Gallen calls the little t, these are all of the cultural things we wrap the tradition in. What language we use, what visual forms, type of music, you know, whether you have organ and guitar, you know, is that big T or little T? You know, that's obvious, it's little T. And these, the amazing things about this, that the conventions that in one generation are new innovations, in the next generation are sacred tradition. I don't know, I've heard that when organs came in, they were just an abomination in the church. Has anybody else heard that?
Well, yeah, Calvin preached very strongly against them. In 300 years, there was no organ in the church in Geneva.
Weren't they considered worldly or just part of the courts of the kings? And am I?
Yes, very much.
So it shows how a new language form comes in, and in 100 years or so, that's the old sacred way to talk. And once we can start seeing this, I think as a congregation, we can at least realize what area that we're having our discussion in. And it also gives you a way of setting priorities. What is more important to really work for renewal? If part of the tradition is missing, then that becomes most important. Well, are there any other? Is that clear before we move on? I want to make sure that point is clear. Does anybody have a question on some part of worship, or whether or not it would be a tradition or a convention? Or is that, it's fairly... Okay. Now, I'm going to move on through these charts and get back to... instead of looking at the chart, I want to just talk about ritual for a while. And the problem that we in the Lutheran Church stands in the Protestant tradition, here I'm using the word tradition again in a different way, but we stand in the line of a Protestant heritage, and when that Lutheranism was really brought over to the United States, in our life here in the United States, it has been more influenced by other Protestant families. And probably the number one characteristic of Protestantism is that the main form of communication is verbal. And the farther you move in the Protestant line, the more it's, you know, the service is centered on a verbal reading, a verbal sermon, and it's, well, do you agree? Would we agree on that? The problem is what we lose with that. Now, I'm not going to end up saying we shouldn't have a sermon, or we shouldn't read, or we shouldn't have any verbal, but the verbal should be part of a much larger picture of what not only Christian, but Jewish and almost every culture in the world has understood without really defining it, what is meant by ritual. And by not really practicing ritual and understanding it, we lose. Now, here's an example. I have a friend who's a Lutheran pastor in Salt Lake City, and the amazing thing about Mormon children is that their festivals, that the story is portrayed in great pageant. Is anybody familiar with that? You know, you dress up as the pioneers going across to Utah, and you enter into that drama, and the children dress as parts of that drama. And by the time this is repeated, and a ritual is something that is repeated over and over again, that's even how the word gets a bad name. You say, oh, it's just a ritual. You ever heard that? And that means it's been repeated so many times it's dead. Living ritual is also repeated, because a Mormon child, all through his or her growing up years, year after year after year, takes different parts in this drama, in this pageant, and dressing up as the pioneers. And more than the words that are said, but by being in that drama, the Mormon child becomes really part of that story. You know, and sometimes we read Mormon doctrines, you know, about the afterlife and about the doctrines of God and angels and marriages in heaven. And we, after we read all this, we tend to say, how can anybody believe that? Have you ever thought that? Why don't we just go and explain it to them and they'll all be converted? The reason is that they did not grow up
as little children learning first those doctrines, but their story of their life became part of the story of that family, that ritual family, you know, and try to convert a Mormon. You know, now I'm not just going to say, well, this is, becomes a technique to keep our people from falling away. Okay, now here's another example of how ritual works. And this takes place two places, in Romania and Holden Village. But I was watching television, and there was a series on world religions on educational TV maybe 5 years ago. Do anybody remember the name of that series? Okay, but
something like Pathways or...
Yeah, and the same person did the interviewing every time. He was from England. And I forgot his name, too. But you could tell each time when it focused on a different family of faith how deeply he was touched or not touched by that family of faith. And some of them he was very moved by, and I think mainly like American Protestantism, he felt like he wanted to run. But one of the most things that moved him the most was the Romanian Orthodox Church, and he was there for Easter. And they showed this ritual of, and what the entire village was there in the church for the Easter Eucharist. And you saw the village, old, young, babies, young children, elderly men and women, some that could hardly move, standing in a line, then kneeling down, crawling on their hands and knees under the altar table and coming out of the other side of the altar table and standing up. Okay, now the interviewer was sure these peasants didn't know what they were doing. He was fairly certain of that, so he went out to a farm, saw a farmer out in the field that he knew had been there, went there with an interpreter, and asked this farmer in Romanian, or the interpreter asked him, and it came back, I think, I'm remembering this right, if he knew the meaning of crawling under the altar, and the farmer looked at him like, you mean you don't understand? He said, you see, when we're baptized, we're buried with Christ, and then we rise with Christ, and we go under the altar to know that. That's not his exact words, but that's, imagine the hours and hours and hours of verbal instruction to sit down and try to teach this Romanian farmer about what it means to die and rise with Christ. Okay, now, so we, the last 2 years here at Holden, I was just joking at the planning service for the Easter Vigil. I told them about the Romanian Orthodox Church, and I said, why don't we crawl under the altar? So I just by saying it here, there's be sure to be three people that will make you do it. So we did it, and I said, well, probably nobody will go, maybe a few kids. Everybody crawled, everybody from the youngest child to Dorothy Carroll, who's in her late 80s. We had to kind of pull her through. And then as each person came out, and we made the altar kind of like a tunnel, put a blanket over it with an opening at both ends. And then as each person came out and stood up, we signed them with the sign of the cross and said, you were buried with Christ and you were raised with Christ. And, you know, I can't explain the experience, but there were tears, and the smiles of people coming out of that table were from ear to ear. And now you see what we're talking about when we talk about ritual. We're talking about getting together and really in fun creating a drama, telling a story, and then participating in that story, and by participating in the story, we become one with the story. And we become connected to the story in a way that I don't think you could do with 1,000 class lectures. on the theology of Easter. And now my problem would be to ever do this in the parish. I mean, they'd really think, you know, some of you are probably saying, well, we're just trying to change from this to this, and he wants us to all be crawling under the... But I'm, so maybe not, but what I'm doing is I'm giving an example of what ritual can be. Now, I want to go back now to the words of Jesus, and there's no question, you know, some parts of the New Testament, the Bible scholars say, well, did Jesus really say this? You know, or did the early church say Jesus said this? If you've been to seminary, you know that's what you spend a lot of time on. And I think Jeremias and the others that have studied the Eucharist and the Eucharistic words of Jesus, you know, there can be no question that Jesus said these words, do this in remembrance of me. Now I want to show you how we've Protestantized in a way those words. Jesus said, do this in memory. I'll say that's one way to translate it in English, in memory of me. Okay, now, this became the source of a great argument over the true presence of Jesus in the sacrament. Remember how we used to argue? Because we'd say, I remember in this, when I was in catechism, I had my father for a confirmation teacher, and one thing he did well was draw all kinds of little pictures on the board, and I can close my eyes and still see them on the blackboard. Another example of pictures. But I always this one I don't quite remember. But I know he had Lutheran here and all other Protestants here and Roman Catholics over here or something. And Roman Catholics say the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. And then other Protestants say that it only symbolizes the body and blood of Christ. And then Lutherans say something else. We don't quite know. In with and under. Okay, but we were critical of other Protestants because they would only say it's only a memorial, a meal. Do you remember that? And this was important to other Protestants because if you go into a Protestant church, another Protestant church, often a Baptist church, they know that they have the pulpit here on a stage and then there's a table down here. You familiar with that? And then almost always on the table, if they bought it from a church supply store, which we usually do, that's shared by all traditions. And it's better not to, but I won't go into that. But they almost always say, in remembrance of me, don't they? Or do this in remembrance of me. Okay, so we said, well, that's all it is to them, is a memorial meal. And when we said that's all it is, they were thinking of the word memorial really the same way we are, and we all had lost the Hebrew understanding of memorial that really was in the mind of Jesus because Jesus had a Hebrew mind. What was a memorial? It was a memorial was you're here in your history and you're part of a family. And what makes this family is an event in the past. Now, to remember or memorialize that event is not what we think of it, is to sit here and just in our mind to go back and think about it. Isn't that our usual definition of remember? Go back and think about it. But what it meant to the Jew was to take that event, bring the event to the present, and do that event in a ritual drama so that as you do the ritual drama, you become part of the event. Now this is really a mind-buster. Is that a word? Mind-buster for ecumenical relationships, because Protestants always says it's only a memorial meal. And Lutherans would say it's the true body and blood of Christ, but actually it means the same thing. Because it is to memorialize, is to bring Christ into the present and then participate in Christ. Now, how the Hebrews did this, you know this if you go to a Jewish Passover. And it was a privilege that Karen and I had once to be invited to a Jewish Passover and to be the only non-Jewish people there. And we started at 7 and we finally had the full dinner at 11 o'clock. But what I remember about that is how in so different, many different places in the Passover is that you're bringing that Egypt event into the present and saying, we walk through the sea. We left Egypt. Not they, but we, and you participate in that. Now, when Jesus said, do this to remember me, it was the same, because we are a family of faith, and what forms us as a family is the death of Jesus Christ on the cross and the resurrection. The Easter faith that forms us as a family. Now, when Jesus said, do this to remember me, he was thinking Hebrew. I believe that he was saying, bring the event into the present, dramatize it, ritually act it out, and then you are incorporated into the event. And now, how do we do that? And I want to show two ways. And it's around these two ways, I think, that the entire worship life of the Christian church evolves. One is a weekly event, and one is an annual event. And the weekly event, of course, is the Eucharist. And how do we tell the story ritually every Sunday? Well, first of all, we gather, and then in a different way every Sunday, then the story is read. Okay, then not from apostolic times, but we have the creed then that tells the whole story every Sunday, because the scripture we read is always part of the story, but we have the creed that tells the whole story. And then what we do is we bring bread and wine, we bring that forward, and this then is the drama of the coming of Christ. Okay, then the bread is blessed and the bread is broken. The wine is poured out. The wine is poured out. See, I need to have that up here. Then Christ, in his coming, breaks his life on the cross, pours out his life on the cross, and then the disciples share the risen Christ and really become the body of Christ. As they meet the risen Christ. And then in our drama we eat and we drink, and the Christ who is broken and poured out becomes one with us. Now this is ritual. And I think the renewal of the worship life of the church will come again, as we said yesterday, not when we get some more guitars or some more balloons or figure out some way to make it more attractive or more comfortable, but when we finally begin to enter again into a Hebrew mind and realize we're gathering to tell a story. And any way that the drama can enhance the coming forth of the bread and wine as the coming forth of Christ the pouring of the wine and the breaking of the bread is Christ breaking his life, and then the sharing of that bread and wine is our participation in the story of Christ coming and breaking his life. Then ritual is happening. And then renewal is happening. And then I think the purpose of every Eucharist is happening, and that is to convert us. Convert us again and again and again to be people who are incorporated into Christ, to be the body of Christ in the world. Now, okay, that's the first. And then I just want to have us all share how can we help each other and help our congregations understand the meaning of ritual. The other great event from the ancient church that's really been being renewed is the whole week of Holy Week and Easter. And what I tell people in parishes, I really encourage them now on Holy Week. You wouldn't think, unless there's an emergency, of coming to the Sunday Eucharist in the middle and just being there for the end, or coming at the beginning and leaving for 20 minutes in the middle. And I tell them now, Holy Week and Easter is one service. All we do is go home for a while and take breaks and rests. And the people that have captured this as one service, I can't begin to tell you how in a congregation of 1,500 in Albuquerque, we had maybe 30 people who were beginning to understand ritual, and how Easter week was something that was the renewal of their Christian life for the year. Because you say the church building during this week now becomes our Jerusalem. It becomes Jerusalem. And we walk into our Jerusalem on Palm Sunday with our palm branches. And then on Palm Sunday we read the whole story of what will happen in this dramatic stage. And I'm not embarrassed to call it a stage, and we're the actors and the actresses. Then Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of Holy Week is a time for just the silent contemplation of the story of Jesus' death and his passion and his suffering. Okay, then on Thursday night, we really ritualize what the meaning of being incorporated into Christ, which will happen on Easter Eve, means. On Maundy Thursday, we have the washing of feet. You know, and it's one ceremony we're kind of afraid of, because now what will people think? And what if they wear pantyhose? and a congregation can begin by just having 12 people represent the disciples. But when we've done this at Holden, it's the same as crawling under the altar. When that washing of feet is done to one another, again, it takes the place of 1,000 sermons on servanthood and what it means to be the body of Christ in the world. And this is our preparation for Easter, because now by the washing of feet, we understand now what it will mean to be Easter people in the washing of feet, in the servanthood. Then we share the Lord's Supper, the Thursday Lord's Supper, the color becomes white. It becomes a little foretaste of where we're going this week. But then at the end of the Lord's Supper, we realize that we're in the drama of where Jesus is going this week, and a moving ceremony is to have the psalm sung by a cantor, and then the entire church, inside of the church, is stripped of every decoration and every movable item, until at the end you leave in silence and it is completely bare, and you feel, and I think you feel very deeply, the humiliation of Christ, how he was stripped of everything now as he goes to the cross. Then you return, and there isn't a benediction then at the end, because the service the service continues on Friday night. And on Friday night, you hear the story read again. Notice how it's story, story, story. And then the traditional Good Friday service, it's now part of the Lutheran Book of Worship, is that you just carry in an old cross, a rough-hewn cross, and then you give thanks together for Jesus' death on the cross. And then you pray for the whole world. And it becomes a strong reminder that Jesus died on the cross for the whole world. Okay, then you return on Saturday night for the Easter Vigil. Now, the Easter Vigil in the ancient church, this was the Passover. Just as the Jewish people had the yearly annual Passover, to the early Christians, it was the Easter Vigil. Why is it so important? One, it's when those who are to be baptized are baptized, and especially adults. If adults can be baptized on Easter Eve, because the symbolism is sharing their death and resurrection at least ritually the same time that Jesus died and was buried and came forth from the tomb. The symbolism of the Easter Vigil is awesome because the church is dark. And in ancient times, everyone would put out all of their lights in their homes, all of their candles, all of their torches, all of their lanterns, all the lights in the town would be out. So it was like the Jewish Passover. You would clear out all of the old leaven and begin with new leaven. But in the Christian tradition, you would clear out all the old light. So now as you come, it is completely dark, and what it says is powerful, that Jesus came and died in a world of darkness and sin. And read the newspaper. I mean, isn't this the world? And then outside of the church, you start a little bonfire, and it's called the New Fire. And this is hard to do in the city when you have city lights all over and street lights and everything. You lose some of the ancient effect. But then from that fire, you light the new Easter candle and you walk into a church room that is completely dark. And then you announce that the light of the resurrection breaks into the darkness of the world. And then you have candle lighting and see as that light now begins to spread. And then you have baptism renewal. And for these 30 or so people in Albuquerque, this was the highlight of their faith life during the year. There, each person would come forward and receive the sign of the cross with water as a reminder of baptism and really a reincorporation into the event of the death and resurrection. And people there, some of them would wait all year. This was the faith event. Holden here, we do it a different way. We take evergreen branches and spray everybody. And we are not careful. I mean, it's a water fight, almost. We sprinkle water all over the worship room on everybody, and then we go back and get everybody a second time until people are wet. You know, and one thing about Holden here, you can get away with things like that. But people are wet, and nobody goes out of there without realizing that they have been drenched again and thereby reincorporated into the death of Jesus. And then to move out of that, either for the first Eucharist of Easter that night or to come back early in the morning for the festival Eucharist of Easter. And then it's so different than the way culture celebrates Easter. You know, you come on culture, you come on Easter with your nice new clothes, and it's kind of a celebration of spring. But the people who have been Holy Week know this is our resurrection. And we have been through the death during the week, and now you feel and you know and you sense that you are incorporated into Christ again. And what I'm really talking about is not just a new worship practice. I'm talking about a call for revival. You know, some churches put out signs saying revival. And we are talking about an annual, and I'm not embarrassed to use that word, we're talking about an annual revival service. And do we need it? To go out into the world with an identity that I'm part of this story. That's so those are two parts of ritual. Now, how do we make this alive in a congregation? Maybe some of you could share both your frustrations and maybe some ideas, and maybe somebody has, I just sit up here in the mountains. You know, how do we encourage what I would say is the very depth of worship renewal in our parishes? And by depth of worship renewal is how do we help people both understand and participate in the renewal of life that comes through incorporation into ritual drama of the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus? That's it. What do you think?
As I listen, I'm exhilarated and depressed at the same time. I'm just thinking about Sunday school. It's going to start in 2 weeks, Archer. And, you know, in Sunday school means you open your teacher manual, and and it's so didactic, and it's so verbal, and it's so in the tradition of what we as Americans think about how we learn things. And if we could go back to Christian education somewhere and revitalize the idea about how we really learn something. And a Lutheran pastor taught me something one time, and I'm not Lutheran, this is why I think kids should go to church instead of go to children's church. Because sitting next to his father, he didn't understand anything that was going on, but what he did get was the feeling of it, that coarse wool suit scratching his face, and the light in the windows, and the sense that this was important to this person. That's what he learned.
I get goosebumps when I have them, see, right? Because, and the reason it brought back a memory, and we had this interesting relationship in Albuquerque of renting out our Christian education wing to a Jewish parochial school during the week. And we had wonderful experiences of relationships and also wonderful fights. You know, Jewish people can help Lutheran people learn how to fight creatively, and we really got into some, and also had just some wonderful. For example, the Feast of Booths. You know, you set a booth up, and you actually go into that booth, and you're there in the wilderness again, with your ancestors in the wilderness. They set it up on Sunday, and after our Eucharist, invited the whole congregation to come out and sit in the booth with them and drink wine. First time we had wine outside of sacramental. But what I wanted to get, the children would practice during the week, and they'd practice down the hall so I could see them from my office. And I would go down and watch, and over, what they were always doing was the children were acting out Jewish history. They were acting out things I'd never heard of. You know, the Feast of Esther, and the kids would dress up in their parts, and they would sing to make our Lutheran Sunday school singing just sick. You know, that's where I was both exhilarated and depressed. And I'd go to our Sunday school on Sunday morning. But what the key to their education, and I think it has been to Jewish education over the years, has been the kids take parts in stories. And a marvelous miracle happens is that they're just not thinking about a story. They become the story.
We did that in my church when I was growing up for the Christmas pageant. I was the angel.
You never forget it.
Really, it's true. I mean, that is one of my strongest memories as a child.
I think more of our education does this now than you at one time. I think there's...
For the Year of Luther, where the theme is the Augsburg theme of proclaiming God's Word,
and on rally day, we are having scenes, which are now being built at our church, of events in Luther's life. We're going to have people dressed up. We're going to have trumpet fanfare. And the whole congregation and the children in the Sunday school will move from scene to scene. There will be tableaus, but with a reader describing. And we have a logo for the year and a theme. And there will be drama, which is happening more and more in our congregation to illuminate this. But the important part is the word and how it's proclaimed. Another thing we have come to doing in our congregation is we have confirmation or affirmation of baptism several times a year, because our program lends itself to when you're through with your coursework, you affirm your baptism. But we always schedule a baptism at confirmation time. And all the confirmands come up to the font and surround the family, and they see what has happened to them when they were very young, most of them, and they are now affirming what happened at that time. And we have heard from the young people that this has been very effective. Mm-hmm. They're not just graduating.
Yeah.
They understand this a little bit.
So actually you're painting pictures.
We're painting pictures.
Right.
Drama.
The idea of the Luther drama came with, I was on a hike this summer with another friend of mine who's a pastor in Idaho Falls, which is about 70% Mormon. And he says, why can't our children learn the story of Luther, you know, the way they did, because that's our family story.
Mm-hmm.
And great, you're doing it. So.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to share a little bit of the frustration that I experienced in our church. I read the drama that is supposed to, that can happen during Easter week, and through, especially through the last period there. But the church that we go to is an immigrant church from Germany,
mm-hmm.
and they're recent immigrants since the last war. And they're biggest service of the year is Good Friday, when all the old German people come out of the woodwork and they come to communion that day,
mm-hmm.
and to try and, you know, from the background that I come from, to realize why they would want communion on Good Friday and Easter Sunday to have communion, to the suggestion of a celebration of the Eucharist on Easter Sunday, well, that's unheard of.
Such an interesting reversal, because that, traditionally that's the one day of the year that the Eucharist isn't celebrated. But it's, yeah, I understand, but I don't know, does anybody have any? I think my brother's a pastor, and he was at Holden this summer for almost a month, and he was going back with an idea of like one Sunday evening a month to have a special worship service, really, where people could come and try ritual in a way that part of the problem on Sunday morning, people feel like it's being pushed on them, to have a time of freedom for people that want to try ritual events. And it's a fun thing about Easter Eve, you know, the only people that are there are the ones that want to. Mm-hmm. They're crazy enough to go through something like this.
Just thinking about drama, as it, changing the subject a little bit, it made me think back fondly at my church in that year, where everyone's favorite Sunday, I think, of the year was Women's Sunday, because they always put on a play. And it was, I was just thinking, it's just not just kids who can act out something. One year they acted out the coming of the first missionaries. I don't know why. And they all had their little hard hats on, representing the pith helmets and stuff. It was just hilarious. But the one I particularly remember is last year when they did Dorcas. Now, how many people even know the story of Dorcas? I vaguely might have heard of it.
She started in early women's circles.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'll never forget it. And I don't think anyone else will ever forget it. It was so real. They were just super. I have trouble imagining how Americans could ever be free enough to sort of spontaneously make up their lines like these women did. They were just great. They were wailing when she died, and they were just... It was an incredible enactment of the story, and it will never be forgotten.
Yeah.
That brings to mind a Christmas, you know, Christmas Eve is traditionally sort of the children's time to put on their pageant. And in our congregation, it was a small congregation, the Sunday school teachers had it. They said, I'm not going to try to force those kids to do that again. They don't like to dress up. They don't find any enjoyment in it. And so a group of adults got together and said, let's do it. And so that year, the kids sat in the pews. And they weren't a part of it, only in terms of if they wanted to sing. And the adults had a great time putting on a children's program for the children. And the next year, we had no problem with the kids wanting to get involved in that. And I think sometimes it's a matter of the adults sitting back too much and saying, entertain us, you know, this is your thing. We'll throw you a little crumb this year, and you can do your thing. And they realize when something's cheapened, but when they see their parents doing the same thing and really enjoying it, really throwing themselves into the role. I remember the one who was the innkeeper. Oh, he loved that role. We had to make the pulpit the inn, and we built a door or a window there, and they'd come up and knock on the pulpit, and he'd open that up. No room, and he'd slam that thing shut, and they had a little dialogue. And he just really enjoyed that, and the kids laughed, and that was great. Sometimes parents have to be the role model.
Does anybody have any experiences of adults and kids working on some of this stuff, like together?
You know, they are.
Because that seems to me to be the best.
You know, but the young people are being involved, certainly.
Done it on retreats, and then when you do it on a retreat, you say, why do we feel so free here? And then we get back to the, that is to just act out the gospel, you know, adults and children too.
I think one thing that's freeing that I've found is sometimes to get out of that church building. There's something about that building which maybe it was the architecture we were talking about yesterday, which sometimes inhibits us and really doesn't allow, when you're sitting in the pew, for any kind of freedom and movement. And, we did, you know, well, I grew up with the tradition of doing sunrise service in the cemetery, not just the church's cemetery, but the county cemetery. And couldn't do that at the present congregation, so we just did a walk around the church with various stations where we stopped to consider different things. And it was simple stuff, you know, earth. And, you know, I encouraged all these people to rub around in the dirt, you know, to think about that, both earth, which is the source of our life, and also that which we fear as it represents death. Yeah, then move to water, and then to song. You're in a different environment, and that frees people up a little bit. But if we were to do that in church, it's like, careful, you're going to get the carpet dirty, and you know, you're going to spill some of that water, and how are you going to get the people out of the pews and up to do that, except you have an usher them in on. Whereas outside, they could just crowd around.
That's one idea, is to move. Our retreats are wonderful places too.
I think that's part of the freedom. To,
you know, and new things finally take hold because they've been tried someplace. It's not that profound. I want to tell one little story at the end, but we have a couple minutes to go.
Just a few comments, several miscellaneous things. One is any talk of drama just provokes such fear in me, that just such inhibition. That's one thing. The other thing about the silence, really hooked into, you're supposed to be silent in church. If I take a non-Lutheran friend of mine to church with me and she talks to me in response to things, I'm embarrassed. I don't want her to talk to me during church. And heaven forbid I have my children with me in church. It destroys the whole experience for me. There's a whole experience of worship that's very individual, and having my children distracts me from getting into it. Last night at Vespers, I was real aware of how good it felt to laugh, but my voice, my little voice in my head kept saying, you're not supposed to laugh in church.
Oh, yeah.
I was laughing all over the place and loving it, but still hearing that little voice, that's not something you're supposed to do.
Yeah. I think if we'd all start sharing, we'd all have these very similar recordings going. Maybe, and then you have to start to understand that we maybe are those who have started to deal with them, and the need to understand people who haven't. That's. But I know what to. I remember going to a Jewish synagogue, and I just couldn't believe how they were all talking. Wanted to say, don't they know they're in church? And then I remember they weren't.
Even in my church, it was in the bulletin one Sunday, the suggestion that some people want quiet contemplation at the beginning of the service, and please don't chatter so much before the service starts.
I'm just closed with the story. I know we could just continue, but this is how ritual can take on new meanings, I think. But once in Albuquerque, the day after Easter, it was a Monday after Easter, we had a visiting theologian who had been a big executive for the Board of Theological Education for the LCA or something, and was through visiting, and we took him to the Santo Domingo Pueblo of Pueblo Indians. It's the largest Pueblo, and they have dances after Easter. And it's a marvelous sight out on the sacred area because it's such a large Pueblo, hundreds and hundreds of Indian people in their full ancient costume. With, you know, the colors are incredible. You know, you're not allowed to take pictures, so I never, you know, can show what it looked like. But dancing hour after hour after hour, and this theologian was very interested in rituals of other cultures, you know. So finally an elderly Indian man came walking, evidently to go to the bathroom or something, left the dancing. And he says, I'm going to stop and ask him the meaning of this dance. And so he stopped him and asked, would you explain the meaning? And he was expecting some exotic thing from ancient Indian tradition. And this little man, he was only like 5 feet, looked up at him and he said, you see, they killed Jesus on Friday, and then on Sunday he came back to life again, and that's why we're dancing. And he walked away. The theologian just said, oh. I'll never forget that.